My name is Mike Elgin, and this is my Food and Technology Podcast number 17. My guest this week is Sam Slover, the founder of the Sage Smart Food Labeling Platform. Here comes the FatCast. Sam Slover's Sage project is connecting people with better information about food. Sam and his colleagues are building a giant database of ingredients and augmenting it with health information, personalization, and killer design. Here's my conversation with Sam Slover. Sam Slover, welcome to the FatCast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's start with the main question. What is the Sage Project?
Yeah, so the Sage Project is an initiative to give consumers more transparency and insights into the products that they're buying and consuming. One of the things that we've wanted to do, so we're over here, we're a team of designers and dietitians, and one of the things that's kind of constantly bothered us is just how unapproachable this information is. Regular people often have like a really hard time deciphering what this data means, how they should be thinking about it. So we really want to come with a different approach that's more fun, that's more playful, and ultimately have us just like regular people who might not know that much about nutrition be able to make better sense of it.
So there's a lot of data visualization to make the information, clumping together information about a specific type of food or a specific ingredient. And then people can look at the various aspects as it relates to their health and so on. So take me through what actually happens when somebody uses the website. They go there, they sign up, they want to jump right in. Let's start with what kind of questions you ask people and then talk about what you do with their answers.
Yeah, totally. So one of the big things that we are into over here is this idea of personalization. So when it comes to food and diets, we're not all the same, right? Like we all have different interests, we all have different goals, we all have different restrictions when it comes to food. So rather than serve up the exact same data and the exact same information for every person, what we do is we get to know them a little bit, and then the entire platform and the information we show adapts to who they are and what we know they care about. So we'll immediately find some things out about you. So this would be some goals you have. Are you training for a race? Are you looking to improve your digestive health? Are you on a program where you're trying to become more heart healthy? This immediately lets us know what are the types of things in food that we can help highlight, and we can help you find foods that contribute to those goals. We'll also ask you things like, do you have any restrictions, like allergies or ingredients that you're looking to avoid? And then we use that for a couple things. For example, we'll try not to show you products that have those things that we know that you can't have. And if you are ever looking at a product in our system that has those things, we'll immediately warn you. We'll say, hey, this product has tree nuts, and we know you can't have tree nuts. The other things we'll ask are you trying to adhere to any sort of diet? And then we'll prioritize showing you information that is based on diet. So like paleo people are fundamentally interested in different products and different information about products than vegans or diabetics. So the platform's all about asking you those very like human questions and then prioritizing which data we show based on what we know about you. The final thing that we do there is if you're ever looking at like the nutrition panel of a food product, all those percentages you're seeing are based on this concept of like a 2,000 calorie daily diet. It turns out that most people, that's like a generic number that doesn't fit most people. So for example, my daily calorie needs might be 2,800 calories, whereas my mom, her calories might be 1,700. So we ask some questions to get to know what your actual caloric needs are, and then we're able to change the percentages that you see on the platform based on what's more accurate to you and your body type.
Now, you mentioned that you try not to show foods that people can't eat based on their profile. And so let's say, for example, somebody's a vegetarian and they go to find out, you know, a bag of potato chips, and then you know that there's animal products in that. And you'll, of course, alert people to say, wait a minute, you said you were vegetarian. You might not want to eat this.
Yeah, exactly. So it would pinpoint the fact that this is a product that has something in it that's not right for you. So there's two ways we would do that. One is that if you're browsing through chips, you Well, you may eventually see that product, but it'll certainly come after you've looked at all the vegetarian options. So we'll deprioritize showing it to you. And then if you actually go in and look at that product, we'll show you that this does not fit with a vegetarian diet.
Now, I understand you want to come out with some mobile apps as well. Do you have a sense of when those are going to hit?
Yeah, so we're working on them right now. We always say, get it out as quick as we can. Which is why, you know, go web first, get people using it, and then build mobile based on how we're seeing people use it, which is what we're doing now.
And you're doing iOS and Android?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, great. And how many products, food ingredients do you have in your database right now?
Yeah, so we have basically all the products you would get in a store like Whole Foods or any other natural or organic store. So it's just under 20,000 products. It's going to be every staple product you could possibly find. So, you know, red bell pepper, green bell pepper, steak, lemon, all those things we'll have. And then we'll also have all the packaged products that you would find in a Whole Foods type store. And now we're expanding to get much more like, let's say, conventional products or the types of things you would get in every other type of store.
I see. So why do you say that you go after the stuff in a Whole Foods kind of store? Because is it because you see that your target audience would be the type of person who would shop at Whole Foods rather than Safeway or something like that?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for that. One, we made the decision early on that it's more useful to get all products for one store or one type of shopper rather than getting some products for every store. It's just more useful when you can do complete coverage in one store. And then you're exactly right. The other thing is, most of our early adopters tend to be people who are more, let's say, conscious about their diet, or they're already doing these things where they have to be very careful about how they're making choices around data. And what we found is a lot of those people are already shopping at a Whole Foods. So as far as early adoption, it's kind of a fit.
Where does the information in the database come from? Are you getting it from Whole Foods or other stores? Are you getting it from volunteers? How are you getting that information in there?
Yeah, so from a couple different avenues. One is that a lot of the brands on the platform are partners of ours, and they're contributing this information. A big thing is with brands is a lot of them want to be more open with their data and want to help consumers like navigate their product catalogs a little bit easier. So they work with us to be able to do that. The other way we're doing it is we are partners with Whole Foods and we have access to their stores.
And Trader Joe's as well, right?
We're actually not currently partners with Trader Joe's, although we do have some products that have been added from different users and different brands. But Whole Foods is our key partner, which is great because Whole Foods actually gives us access to their stores where we can go in, take photos of products, we do product research, so on and so forth. So it's really a combination of us doing it in stores, like our team of researchers, and then as well, brands contribute data to us.
Now, of course, there are some types of companies that want to be transparent about what's in the food, where the food comes from, and then there are other companies that don't want that at all. How do you extract information from companies that really want to hide what they have in their products?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, as a designer, I've been working on this this project and similar types of projects for a few years. And what I've seen over the last few years is more and more brands are getting the fact that they can't really hide their data anymore. And so what we're seeing more and more is brands wanting to be open and say, hey, like we get this is coming and it's unavoidable to us. So better to like be proactive about it and work with a company that's doing this in a kind of a smart, intuitive way for consumers. We actually aren't we're not really getting blocked on data anymore. We did at first, but now what we're seeing is brands are really kind of getting the message from consumers that this is an expectation at this point. And they're now trying to come up with ways to get the information to customers. For some of the more conventional products, what they're, you know, kind of the where the industry is going is for existing products that maybe aren't sourced in the ways that they would want them to be sourced from, or have ingredients that consumers are increasingly kind of like sketched out about or worried about. They're actually reformulating those products anyways. Like they're changing the ingredients, they're changing how they source so that they ultimately can be more information or more open with the information. So it's kind of like a two-part factor, right? Like one is brands see that consumers are demanding it, so they're increasingly forced to be more open. And two, they get, because that trend is happening, they're actually changing a lot of their products. So for example, like Kraft macaroni and cheese, like completely changed how they make that product because the way they were making it didn't really vibe with being a more open company.
One of the chunks of information you provide to people is that you show where the ingredient or the food comes from. It comes from a ranch in Texas, or it comes from China or whatever. Where do you get this information about where the ingredient or where the product is originally sourced from?
Yeah. So that's one that we get in a couple ways. One is we have an in-house team of researchers who researches supply chain. And then, you know, marks it up on a map. What we'll then do is we'll reach out to the brand and say, hey, here's the research we've done. Here's where we've been able to see your stuff's coming from. Can you give us any more specific information? And what we find is many brands actually like to go in and say, here's, you know, the farm we use during the winter season. Here's the farms we use during the summer season. Here's where our manufacturing facility is on the East Coast versus the West Coast. And people actually, the brands will want to come in and contribute that information. So yeah, it's a process of both our team of research and researchers and brand input.
Now, when you look at an ingredient right now, you buy a product in the store. It comes in a bag or a box or something like that. And you look at the packaging, and there's a list of ingredients. And what that list of ingredients shows is essentially a negotiated compromise between the industry and the regulators, and the really powerful industries, food industries, essentially have to report fewer things. There are a bunch of loopholes. They can call things manufacturing aids, even though it's an ingredient. And so if it's not really an ingredient, it's a manufacturing aid, they don't have to put it on the label, even though chemicals from that end up in the product itself. They're famously, the wine industry, there's something like, there's a list of 200 things you can add to wine without mentioning it on the label. So it varies according to products, the product types, the industries. And there's also a lot of variation. Some companies sometimes add something, sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes it comes from a factory where peanuts are processed, sometimes it doesn't. And do you have any plans for the future where you can actually find out what's really in the products and not just what the company says is in the products?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's really interesting because there is a lot of variance in how products can be made. And sometimes the companies themselves may not have like exact data on their own products, which to me is kind of fascinating. So there's a couple things with that. One is like testing, being able to do lab sample testing is kind of key and something we've talked a lot about doing. The other is helping consumers demystify the fact that there is this amount of variance. And one example of that would be, you know, there's ingredients that are very similar, but essentially can come under hundreds of names. So one company might call something one way, another company might call it a different way, but it's actually the same ingredient. Sugar is probably the clearest example of that. It can come under thousands of names on the label, some of which look better than others, right? Like organic cane sugar might look better than high fructose corn syrup or sugar,
right?
But at the end of the day, they're added sugars. So helping consumers understand that this ingredient may also be known as this ingredient, and here's what these ingredients do. So, you know, kind of don't be tricked by the fact that some ingredients might sound better, but actually are exactly the same thing.
You're flirting with the idea of providing health advice, but the health of food, it's very controversial, almost to the point of being a religion for a lot of people. For example, just comes to mind, some people believe that farmed fish is likely to be very toxic, very unhealthy. Other people think, well, it's better for the environment, and so on. There's a lot of disagreement, is what I'm saying. And how do you resolve those differences of opinion that exist in the public? Let's just take another one, GMOs. How do you advise people on things that are controversial?
Yeah, so I mean, that's always the key question, is there's so many different viewpoints in food. And there's actually, I mean, I think people would argue there's canonical, correct viewpoints in food. But when it comes down to it, there's lots of different ways that potentially are the right way. It's picking what's the right way for you. And I think that's built into our platform in a pretty strong way, where you say, hey, here are the things that I care about. You know, I'm somebody who's on the ketogenic diet. I'm looking for products that don't have, you know, that don't have refined sugars and don't have carbs. And I don't want anything that has GMOs. And so these are the types of things you can tell the platform. And then that those types of products will be shown to you, and that information will be highlighted when you're looking at products. So that's one way, is to make it just really customized, so you can say, I know, you know, there's not one way, but here's my way, and here's what I'm interested in. The other thing that we're doing now, that we'll be launching soon, is the ability for different diet types to curate the platform for themselves. And what I mean by that is, right now we have a bunch of different data filters and data standards that you can sort by. So these would be things like diet types and some preferences you have around ingredients. But what this next feature that we're building will say is, if somebody who has a very specific diet, let's say they're a vegan who does triathletes and, you know, they don't want anything with GMOs, they can go in and help curate the platform for other people who have very similar diets to them. And what's kind of cool about that is it allows food communities to help organize the grocery store for other people in that food community. So it's kind of like a collective action that they can take to say, hey, here are products that we found work really well for our diet and what we, you know, what our own preferences are.
Do you have an opinion on the recently passed GMO labeling law? Just for listeners who may not be aware of what's happening, the industry, the food industry in general, with a few exceptions, has resisted the labeling of foods as GMO because they believe that if people see it, they won't want to buy the product. They feel that they're better off without anyone knowing what's in it. But then Vermont passed its own GMO labeling law, and then the industry freaked out and said, you know, what are we going to do? Now we have to do different labeling for Vermont. What should we do? So they pressed Congress. Congress passed a law. I believe President Obama signed it Friday. And what this, it's kind of a watered down labeling law where companies will have the option to either put wording that says that there's GMOs, an icon or some kind of, you know, graphical revelation that there's GMOs, or they can put a QR code on there, which, you know, basically lets people who have the right kind of app find out that it's, whether it's GMO or not. But the lay public will just see this gobbledygook on the label and then they won't really know, and everybody's happy. So my first thought was, wow, this is the best thing that ever happened for QR codes. But what was your opinion on this new law?
Yeah. So, you know, for me and for our team over here, we thought, you know, it's better than nothing. Right. A lot of the concerns around the fact of saying, hey, if you put this mark that it has GMOs on it, will then make people think like it's not good or they shouldn't buy it. A lot of that could have been, we felt, could have been solved with the design of that mark, and just what, you know, there's different ways to present a mark like that. And we think it could have been solved in design. So we could have gotten that ideal scenario, which is it's actually labeled. But from our perspective, the real ideal would be, not only is there a mark on the product around that lets the consumer know that, hey, this would have GMO ingredients in it or non-GMO ingredients, but if there is a GMO in the product, explain to the consumer why a GMO is used. And maybe that happens through a broader resource that's a QR code. But I think a lot of times companies aren't giving consumers enough credit. And what we mean by that is, you know, it would be most interesting to say, hey, this has a GMO in it, and oh yeah, here's why GMOs would be used in crops like that. And so consumers can actually understand the science around GMOs, because the truth of it is there's different use cases for why GMOs are used in products and in crops. And right now that's completely hidden from the end consumer. So I think the first step we could take is to make that more clear, why GMOs are actually used in crops.
Would your app be able to use a QR code that is there for GMO labeling, or the barcode, or both? By, you know, you can imagine scanning the app, maybe the QR code identifies, in addition to whether it's GMO or not, maybe it identifies the exact food, the company, et cetera, which you could then use to pop up, you know, without any typing or anything, your interface for that particular food. Is that something that you looked at, or that's a possibility?
Yeah, so we could basically do that immediately with the new app that we're creating, which is to say, hey, if you want to look up this product, not only will we have the best visual resource for like learning about it, its nutrition, its ingredients, its supply chain, but we can tell you whether it's GMO or non-GMO. And in our platform, I can say we would solve it the way that I just mentioned, which is if it does have a GMO, we would want to provide context in why a GMO would be used in that type of crop, rather than just saying yes or no, because we think, you know, giving consumers the nuance around these things is actually more meaningful. So yeah, that would be our take on it. Yeah, the other thing is that's interesting is internally, we essentially already know which products have GMOs and which products don't have GMOs. And it's actually pretty, you know, for consumers, there's a kind of 5 or 6 core crops that tend to be GMO crops. And so if you're looking at something that has soy or canola or corn in its ingredient list, and that product is not non-GMO verified, meaning it hasn't gone through a non-GMO verification, those are the products you want to be a little bit more careful about if you're looking to avoid GMOs, because they have an ingredient that's associated with these GMO crops.
Now, you're tackling a huge issue. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of data visualization, which means a lot of design, you're designing apps, and it's all free right now. How do you intend to monetize, Sage?
Yeah, so the big way that we're monetizing is it's always free for consumers. What we found is that more and more brands and more retailers being able to show good, personalized, easy to understand nutrition details about their products is becoming something that every food brand and food retailer has to think about and has to do. So where we're actually making money is when we work in a retail setting or with a brand. So we essentially are solving the problem for them of how do they best relay their nutrition to their customers.
Now you also co-founded something called Learn It Live. What is Learn It Live?
Yeah. So Learn It Live is a company I founded many years back. That's all about live online health and wellness classes. So we were one of the very first platforms that did live online classes, specifically in the vertical of like nutrition, yoga, cooking. So you could actually get on your computer or your phone and do like a live cooking class or a live yoga class. And it's something that I started with my brother, actually. And where that came from is we had both lived abroad in the Peace Corps. And we had seen firsthand that internet connectivity was really good, but access to local classes could sometimes just not exist. So it was bridging the gap between places where experts and classes were plentiful with places that didn't have those classes but did have strong internet.
And you were like in India and a couple of other cool places, right? Where did you go in the Peace Corps?
Yeah, so I did a stint. It's actually, I'm a dual citizen with Canada, and so I was doing the Canadian version of the Peace Corps down in Bolivia.
I see.
So I was doing microfinance.
What is the Canadian version called? What is that called?
It's called CIDA.
Okay.
CIDA.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It's the Canadian International Development Agency.
I see.
Very, very similar to the Peace Corps, just in a Canadian way, of course. And then, yeah, so microfinance in Bolivia, and I also did microfinance over in India.
That's cool. And right now you're an adjunct professor, among other things, right?
Yeah, so I teach a class at a New York University master's program called the Interactive Telecommunications Program, ITP. And I teach a class called Designing for Data Personalization. So basically the concept of the class is there's so much data out there now, and it's embedded in so many of our daily interactions. How can we take all that data and come up with good design that personalizes it for, you know, for each individual person who's looking at it? So, you know, it's very similar to what we're doing. The idea of taking all this nutrition information and helping people identify like what in this nutrition information matters to them and is meaningful to them.
Now, you were in the Peace Corps, as we mentioned, and I believe you started out professionally as a journalist. And if that's true, how does a journalist become a designer and a developer? How does that happen? I want to make sure it doesn't happen to me.
Yeah, totally. So I kind of fell into this. I was writing, this was up in Canada at the time, and I was writing for actually a business publication. And this was around the time where a lot of print publications were going digital. And I just happened to be the guy on staff who had built websites in the past. So they assigned me to, when I wasn't writing, to work on bringing the articles online. And so I ended up building a website. And through that, I just, you know, I designed, I built, and I increasingly got better. So I was one of those people who didn't really have a formal education in computer science, but I learned this all on my own just by doing projects.
That's awesome. That's a great story. Now, one last question before I let you go. What do you envision, and this is going back to Sage, what do you envision the Sage project in the best case scenario 5 years from now? How will it work? How will somebody use Sage when they're shopping and when they're exercising, when they're living their life? How do you envision this? Where is it going? What things are on the horizon that you think are possible with the Sage project?
Yeah, so we want to really be the like go-to place to be able to learn about and see trends in your interactions with food over time. So this would mean it's embedded in every place where you buy food. It's embedded with every product that you purchase. So you know that the go-to place to learn about nutrition, whether you're in a store or you have a product in front of you, is through our app. And then because we have all these retailers and stores and brands with their products on our app, it then becomes really easy for you to track what you're doing over time. And ultimately see which, you know, see trends, see visualizations that then gives you information that allows you to make better decisions.
Well, that all sounds great, and the app looks great. The data visualization is really great. It's so appealing to look at, and it sort of gives you a sense of what all these food products. I really recommend that everybody go and check it out. Sign up. What is the URL for your website?
Yeah, so we are at sageproject.com.
Wonderful. Sam Slover, I want to thank you so much for coming on the FatCast.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
I'd love to hear from you. Email your ideas and feedback to mike@elgin.com. Thanks for listening to my weekly food and technology podcast, and don't forget to share it with your friends. My name is Mike Elgin. There goes the FatCast.